Now broadcasting the Dr. Nilda Business Foresight Show, positioning your business with strategies for an extraordinary future. Dr. Nilda features expert guests from diverse backgrounds to bring you their stories and strategies that have helped them reach their success. The diversity in industries gives you that panoramic view from an array of industries. They are innovators, thought leaders, trendsetters, and strategists. Here, Dr. Nilda reveals strategies that will position you to be on the cutting edge and be able to do what you love with the people you like, making the profits you want to live the lifestyle that you have dreamed of. And now, here's your host, Dr. Nilda Perez.
Welcome back to another Dr. Nilda Business Foresight Show. And today I have with me Patrick Daly from Ireland. Very exciting. I want to read you his bio because the topic that he's going to be talking about today is doing business internationally. He is an amazing person. Patrick Daly is the founder and managing director of the Alba Consulting. He is also current chairman of the Exporters Association Supply Chain Series and a former president of the Association of Latin American Trade Forum. Patrick works with many of the top Fortune 500 companies in manufacturing, distribution, and logistics. His services are in Europe, in Asia, the Americas. It helps them to achieve dramatic improvement in their logistics capabilities and performance. Patrick is an accomplished consultant. He is a speaker. He is a trainer. He is an author. And he has been active in the logistics sector for over 25 years. His new international supply chain relationship is due to be published by Cronin Page, which is in Ireland, I believe, right?
That's in London, in the United Kingdom.
In the United Kingdom. Yeah. Patrick has delivered trainings in topics related to supply chain logistics in Ireland, China, India, and the UAE. Patrick is married. He has two children. He lives in Dublin. He is married to a Spaniard woman, and he speaks fluent Spanish, which was very impressionable to me. He lived in Spain for 10 years, and he is a great fan of learning foreign languages and also speaks French. He speaks Italian, Portuguese, and German. Patrick is an active sportsman, and he completed the Dublin Marathon in 2011. I tip my hat to you. So welcome, Patrick. How are you today?
I'm very well, Nilda. Delighted to be here with you. Thank you for the introduction.
So this is our morning, so as you can see, which is probably why I'm still kind of trying to figure out my morning. And but in Ireland, you're actually 4 hours ahead?
Right at the moment, it's 5 hours because we've both moved to daylight saving time.
I'm really excited to have you here. Patrick, we met a few weeks back because we both share a mentor, which is Alan Weiss, and you gave a talk about international business, and yeah. I was quite taken by that because I am bilingual. I'm also between two cultures. My mom is Peruvian. My dad was Puerto Rican, and I was born in America. So I feel like I have all of these different ethnicities, and I was very fascinated by your talk. One of the things that you said is that you believe that smaller and medium-sized businesses need to be concerned about international business. Yeah. I want you to talk to me about that, international business and globalization. How so?
Well, I was staggered to find on my research that in America, in the United States, only 1% of companies export outside the United States, and there are 30 million businesses in the United States. And these figures come from the International Trade Administration. So it's a government body. Right. And that compares very unfavorably to other developed countries. So, for example, in Canada, somewhere in the region of 10% of firms in Canada export. In the United Kingdom, which is our nearest neighbor, it's also 10%, maybe 12%. And then those countries that are at the top end of exporting, so countries like Germany, Japan, my own country, Ireland, the Netherlands, and countries like that, the percentages are even higher. So for me, there is a huge latent and untapped well of opportunity for small and medium-sized American companies to get involved in working overseas, whether that's on the inbound side in terms of sourcing materials, or whether it's on the outbound side in terms of developing international markets. So you say to yourself, well, the United States, the biggest economy in the world, something like $18 trillion, mm-hmm. got 320 million people. You all speak English, same legal system from coast to coast. Why would I bother? And the reason you would bother, because of those 1% of American companies that do export, they are more productive, they're more profitable, and they stay in business longer than companies that don't export in the United States. So therefore, I think you might remember the day I spoke in New York. I spoke yes. about this this diagram where I had on one axis, I had desire, and on the other axis, I had need. Right. So for example, you could have high desire and high need to internationalize your business. So that would be my case, because I live in a very small country with a small market. And most companies here in Ireland, when they grow beyond medium size, very quickly, they have to become involved in international business, whether it's buying products in to make their products for sale, or buying products in to distribute into our markets, or whether it's to simply to sell their products and grow their markets outside of their home market. In the United States, you don't have that same imperative because of what I said earlier. It's such a large market with kind of built-in customers, so many of them. So therefore, on the need scale, most companies, I guess, in the United States are going to be on the lower end.
On the lower end, right.
Yeah, so therefore you have to work, and I call you have to kind of work then on your desire, because when I put those companies on a matrix, four quadrant matrix, those that have low need to internationalize combined with a low desire, I call them complacent. And I call them complacent because, well, one, because I want to knock them out of their complacency, but two, the reality is that they're giving up the opportunity to be more productive, more profitable, and to stay in business longer. So I guess the challenge for American companies is, if they don't already have the desire, is to develop the desire and become, if you like, what I call more enlightened in that respect. So the big international American names, you know, the Facebooks, the Googles, Dell in its day, these companies got it, and they internationalized very quickly. Some of them were even born global. And I think that there are many, many more American companies of a medium size and a smaller size, so somewhere in the ballpark of $100 million to $500 million turnover, that are missing this opportunity. And I really, I think it's a pity. And I think they could do themselves a big favor by looking outside the United States for opportunities.
Okay, that's amazing. And this was the talk that, and this is exactly how you explained it, that really attracted me to that concept. So why do you believe, I know that you said that there's low desire because there's so much work here. So for a small business or a medium business, what would be the enticement? What would entice them to do this? Explain to me how.
Because it forces them or introduces them to two things. One is diversification and the other is diversity. So in terms of diversification, there are different aspects to it. So let's say you're an American company and you serve markets at home, and you're going to continue serving markets at home, but you're interested in diversifying your supply side internationally. So what will you get from that? Well, you will potentially gain access to new materials that you couldn't access at home, or new products or components that you can use in your production or in your distribution. You will find sources of cheaper supply, maybe, outside the United States as compared to what you will find at home. So, for example, if you're a pharmaceutical company and you're buying certain ingredients, perhaps you can purchase the same ingredient in a country like India or China more economically than you can in the United States. Also, if you have sole supply of certain critical items, you will be able to find alternative suppliers in different places, and therefore you can leverage better negotiation strategies and price advantages, and you're not beholden to any single supplier. So that makes you more robust, it diversifies your risk, and that contributes then to your longevity. The cheaper source of materials and your better bargaining position improves your profitability.
Okay.
If we add on to that, then say the demand side. So now not only are you sourcing materials and products outside of the United States, now you're looking to sell them outside the United States as well. So you are going to open new markets in different parts of the world where those countries are at a different point in the economic cycle. So let's say, for argument's sake, there was a downturn in the United States in your sector, and you export maybe 50% of your production, say to the European Union or to Latin America or to East Asia. While the United States economy may decline, those economies may be up, and vice versa. So you have diversified the risk on your sales side also, because each part of the world is in a different phase in the economic cycle. Now, I guess sooner or later they tend to follow each other because the economy of the world is becoming more and more coupled. But right at the moment, there was a period of time during the Obama presidency when the United States, its growth far outpaced the growth in the European Union. And notwithstanding the fact that the American economy continues to do well under President Trump, the European Union economy is actually growing faster than the American economy. So Europe has picked up pace. So those companies that only work in America are not benefiting from the European recovery.
Okay.
China also, some years ago, it seemed to be stalling, and now it seems to be growing rapidly again.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so those companies that are not involved in Asia are missing out on that. So those are some of the benefits. So you get that diversification of markets. Also, when you work internationally, you pick up on new requirements in products and services. So, for example, let's say you're in the food sector. And you're exporting a product, and you're looking to export a product, say, into the European Union from the United States, and you must adjust that product for the tastes in that country.
Right.
And therefore, you pick up on ideas and innovations that maybe you can bring home and develop or make additions to your home-based products that you never would have occurred to you if you hadn't been working in a foreign place.
Exactly.
And I guess also simply the scale. So, for example, if you look at companies like Apple and Google, they think in a global scale. So they don't think, well, this is American, there's 330 million people. They think this is the world and there's 7 billion people here. Now, we're talking about smaller and medium-sized companies. But I think they probably need to take the same kind of attitude and the same kind of mindset. So that's diversification. The other element is diversity. So this is almost inside the company, because when you begin to internationalize your company, you must diversify your workforce, and you must diversify your thinking, and you must diversify your worldview. And that seems to generate a kind of an internal innovation. You will more than likely start to recruit people from different ethnicities, from different backgrounds, people who have command of different languages. And that
cultures?
Yes, different cultures indeed.
Cultures. Right.
And that mix seems to spark innovation inside companies. So you'll see that the most innovative companies also tend to be the most diverse companies. And then this in turn, it's almost like a virtuous circle. It allows you then to connect better with new places. So if you say, okay, well, I'm interested in East Asia, and I begin to hire people, say, with a Korean background or a Chinese background or Japanese background, who understand those cultures and those languages, well, then all of a sudden you're able to make connections in those places much easier. So you get all of this kind of effervescent, unexpected synergies and serendipities occurring inside the company. I think it's all of that contributes to those three things: being more productive, being more profitable, and being longer lasting as a company.
Okay. So when we're talking about a company such as mine that is more service, although I do have products, but we're more service oriented, mm-hmm. how does international or globalization help a company like mine?
Well, I guess in the same way, but I guess the materials are right. are. But all of the points made about diversification and diversity, I think still apply. And perhaps what happens actually is, if you're a small consultancy practice, or even what's called a lone wolf consultancy practice, so you're a solo practitioner, you become more diversified in yourself because you get exposure to places and to peoples and to cultures. And you may, if you wish or you're so inclined or you have the necessity, learn foreign languages as you do that. For example, you may know in our community, with Alan Weiss's mentor community that you referred to earlier, one of the people in that group is Corey Shanahan.
Okay.
Yeah. So Corey Shanahan has a practice in Washington, D.C. And Corey, as you can probably guess from her surname, is also Irish, just like myself. But she's been living in the United States for many, many years. And Corey speaks Russian. So Corey has clients in Russia.
Fantastic.
And she is able to relate to them. She's able to role play situations with them in Russian. So, for example, if they were dealing with a consultant that only spoke English, they would have to do the role plays in English. And then when they're thinking about the situation they're in, they'd have to be translating. But what did Corey say to me?
Exactly. Yes.
Because she can do it in Russian, it's straight through. Right. I, for example, as you said, I lived in Spain for 10 years. My wife is Spanish. We live in Ireland, but the language spoken inside our house every day is Spanish. Right. So I've been speaking Spanish every day since I was 21 years old, which is 31 years ago. So I travel comfortably with large multinational clients to places like Puerto Rico and Uruguay and Argentina and Spain. And I can interact with everybody in the plant from the shop floor all the way up to the site director. And that's the benefit of a language learning at that level. I don't think it's imperative, depending on what business you're in. Maybe we can talk about language strategies later, but depending on what business you're in and what your objectives are, it's not absolutely necessary to have fluent command of a foreign language. But if you do have, it can be a great lever.
Okay, fantastic. As a business foresight strategist, the one thing I know about business is that small businesses are really gaining a lot of ground quickly. And they're becoming big companies. If you think about it, Amazon 8 years ago was being run from from their garage. So, yeah. And they're taking, they're leveraging really quickly and becoming these large, well-known names very quickly. So with that said, what types of companies do you think can gain the most from taking the global view in their business?
I think all types of companies across the spectrum can. So that's manufacturing companies, distribution companies, and service companies. And I guess different companies will approach internationalization in a different manner. So some of those companies that in essence are internet companies, they're born onto a business platform that has no frontiers.
Okay, so technology.
Yeah, the likes of Facebook and Google and the others that are coming that we don't know about yet, that are being born on the internet. These companies almost are born global. But as I said, even with all of those counted, only 1% of businesses in America are exporting their products or services. So there are so many companies that are in conventional business sectors, manufacturing widgets or distributing food or clothing or whatever it happens to be, or delivering services, medical services, accountancy services, professional services, business consultancy, and so on. So there's a huge middle. There's a mass of companies in say the $100 to $500 million range, literally millions of them, who are not taking advantage of international business, and they could. And as I said earlier, they can do it in different ways, and it can also be a journey. So you can see a company maybe starting to source products and materials overseas, and then later they may say, okay, well, you know, we've been dealing with some of these foreign countries, maybe in Europe, maybe in Latin America. Perhaps we could open a market there on the sales side. So they progress to perhaps direct export on an opportunistic basis. You know, they might meet somebody at a trade show somewhere. Let's say it's a company makes, I don't know, shovels, and they're at an agricultural trade fair somewhere, and they meet somebody from Mexico. The guy says, well, you know, I'd like to buy some shovels from you. So it's an opportunistic direct sale. Then people progress on and they develop export channel partners. So they may have to develop distributors in the local markets or resellers, or work with some sort of product aggregator to distribute their products. And then naturally over time, what tends to happen is they start to look, okay, maybe we could form a joint venture with a company in Spain or in Colombia. Or they may say, okay, we actually have got to a stage where our overseas markets are so important, we actually need to have wholly owned production and distribution facilities in those foreign markets. And many, many companies, you know, like in the old days, General Electric and Ford Motor Company and all of these companies went through those kind of stages. But there are so many companies in the, if you like, the non-sexy end of the internet spectrum, with companies that are making real stuff that needs to move over distances to get into people's hands. And, there's a lot of opportunity.
Fantastic. So what are the, because again, so this hypothetically, I want to go global. What are the regions that, of the world that have the what are the sectors and what are the regions of the world that American companies can readily be embraced? And I've been hearing a lot about Singapore. Yeah. Hearing a lot about Singapore. So my question is, if I wanted to start this, where would I start? What are the regions of the world that are embracing globalization?
So this is important. And in the book that you referred to earlier, which is being published by Kogan Page, and that will publish probably in the second half of 2018. There are two chapters that kind of touch on what you're saying there. One talks about how globalization has spread and how it has evened out the playing field or leveled the playing field. But at the same time, not all places are equal. And geography still matters. Physical geography still matters. And it still matters because there are certain trade routes, there are certain countries, there are certain hubs in the world that make it easier to do business in some places than in others. So from an American perspective, I guess the first thing is you want to stack the deck in your favor, and you want to try to work in places where you're going to have an easy entry. And I suppose you're going to have the easiest entry in what's called the Anglosphere. And the Anglosphere are those countries that share common language with the United States. So right on your doorstep, you have Canada, which is a very important economy. It's one of the largest economies in the world. You have a free trade agreement with Canada through NAFTA. And it's relatively easy. I guess it's not a free trade arrangement as we have in Europe, where we have like a common market and we also have a customs union. But in relative terms, it's easy to do business between Canada and the United States. I would say then the next country or pair of countries would be the United Kingdom.
Right.
And Ireland, where there's a great affinity with the United States, you know, and many generations of people from Scotland, from Ireland, from England have emigrated to the United States. And you can see that in people's surnames. There's a cultural affinity. We still speak the same language with certain nuances that are different. So the United Kingdom is again a very, very large economy, one of the largest economies in the world, 66 million people or so. Ireland is a smaller country, but the important thing about Ireland from an American perspective is that Ireland is the country in the world that receives most foreign direct investment from the United States, more than any other country in the world. And Ireland is an ideal platform for American companies that want to access the European Union markets. And that will become more so when the United Kingdom leaves the European Union in March 2019. That will leave Ireland as the only English-speaking country inside the European Union and inside the euro currency zone. So that Ireland-America relationship is going to be, well, it already is extremely important, but it's going to become, I think, more important. And then after that, within the Anglosphere, we have the neighbours down in the South Seas, Australia and New Zealand. Again, very close affinity and ease of doing business. And all of those countries, including the United States, share a common law system. So things related to contracts and property rights and intellectual property, it's very similar arrangements with certain differences, but quite familiar to Americans who want to do business overseas. Going beyond that, then you're talking about places that are very plugged into the international economy, where English is used widely and particularly in business. Places like Singapore, as you mentioned. I would also add to that Hong Kong and the United Arab Emirates, so places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi. So these are great hubs for business in Asia, and they're important business centers in themselves. After that, then we start getting into places where the culture, the business culture, and the language maybe is different. I guess the ones that would be closer within that difference would be the northern European countries within the European Union. So I'm talking about places like Denmark, the Netherlands, Germany, Sweden, Norway, and Finland. And also in Eastern Europe, Poland is a country that has a lot of affinity with the United States. And then we mustn't forget, as we move more into foreign languages, remember that there's something like 47 million people in the United States who speak Spanish either as a first or a second language.
Exactly.
So therefore, the countries of Latin America, starting with Mexico, which is actually in North America, and is also part of NAFTA, so the same as Canada. And despite the bad press that Mexico sometimes receives, it's a country of 120 million people. It's the 14th or 15th largest economy in the world. In 20 years' time, it may be much further up the ranking if they can keep political stability and embed the democracy in all aspects of their society. So Mexico, I think, is a big opportunity, and many, many American companies are already there. In Latin America, I would put Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile in a block of the countries that are most open to business. They belong to an alliance that's called the Pacific Alliance,
right?
Which is a very, the philosophy there is very much business-oriented and free trade-oriented. Two other big countries in Latin America, that are an opportunity, but they're not as open to business, while at the same time being really big, interesting markets. One is Brazil, where the language is actually Portuguese, not Spanish, right. But that's a country of some 200 million people. It's the largest single economy in Latin America. And also Argentina, which is a country of some, I don't know, 46 million people. Argentina has a lot of issues, but Argentina is one of the countries that has the most advanced agricultural science in the world, in terms of precision agriculture. So anybody who's in that space in the United States, Argentina is a country that's really, really on the cutting edge of, okay. of agricultural technology.
Fantastic. Okay. So it's pretty broad, and globalization, and I think technology and technology has definitely, you know, speaking to people in real time has really brought the world together. And so to be able to do business internationally is becoming a lot simpler than it used to be.
Yeah, it is. Okay. That's true, because what's happened is over the last, say, since the end of World War II, there's been three probably major changes that have contributed to this. One is that there's been a huge improvement in transport infrastructure and what's called load unitization. By that, I mean the containerization of sea freight and the introduction of standardized air freight has revolutionized global supply chains. Because you could imagine in 1890, and a ship pulls up at the docks in Boston, and everything inside is in tea boxes and cases, and it's packed all over the place. To empty a ship could take a week and a half. A ship will arrive in Boston today with containers on. It'll be emptied in hours and turned around and on its way. So containerization has revolutionized sea freight. And similarly, there's been huge changes in air freight that has enabled supply chains in cold chain and fresh products. You're in New York, right? So you can go into New York tonight and have a steak, fresh steak from Argentina, right?
Right.
Yeah, you can have
from Brazil. Pacific,
you can have Pacific fresh crab from Alaska in New York this evening. So those types of supply chains have been enabled by revolution in transport technology. The other revolution then has been in information and communications technology. So the ability to pick up a phone or get on Skype or Zoom or any other number of
technology,
communication technologies. Yeah. And then the information technology, the big ERP systems and the supply chain management information systems that lie behind all of the fulfillment and the movement and the sourcing of materials has right. been a tremendous revolution that's ongoing. And then another one that we often miss are the developments in financial services and the deregulation of certain financial services. Some of those have led to problems with credit crunches and bubbles and issues with derivatives and so on. But there's been a lot of positive developments in financial services and financial technology. And those three things together have come to create what is today a global market. So it's never been easier to internationalize, which again makes me wonder, why so few as a proportion of the total, why so few in America are taking advantage of that, when just over the border in Canada, it's 10% is against 1%.
Right. Okay. So I have two last questions, and we are reaching here at the top of the hour. So Patrick, I know that you're known to be able to help American companies identify and exploit international opportunities quickly. Tell me a little bit about this. How do you do this? How do you work? Do you work with American businesses to try to make those alliances, to try to make those connections?
Yeah, well, what we will do is we will help companies, American companies, to formulate and implement internationalization strategies. So it could be on the sourcing side, or it could be on the sales side. It could be in terms of identifying markets to enter and to identify the routes to those markets, or it could be to identify markets that they wish to invest in, that they wish to set up operations in, whether it's distribution or manufacturing or R&D. So I guess it's to go right back to basics in terms of the formulation of the strategy, the why of this, and then from the why to start to develop the how and the where and the what and so on. So to identify markets, see which products will have acceptance, to see what the supply chain options are to set up, whether we need to develop channel partners, distributors, resellers, or so on, what the logistics solutions are going to be, what logistics service providers can bring to the table for us. If they're looking at putting operations in foreign countries, to try to decide where is the best location, which countries offer the best advantages, what the potential benefits are of working with state development agencies in the different countries. So for example, here in Ireland, probably one of the most successful national development agencies in the world is called IDA Ireland, which has been responsible for bringing so much of that American investment here to Ireland. In Mexico, you have a similar organization called ProMexico. In Colombia, you have another one. I think they call it actually ProColombia. Help companies then to develop their corporate language strategies. So for example, I've been reading some interesting cases. When your company begins to internationalize and you're interacting then with people in different countries, if you don't have a language strategy, you get this kind of unfettered multilingualism, and it can be chaos. And so much gets lost, so much gets missed, or people lose confidence because they're not able to work through a certain language or with a certain country, and it can be very, very stop start. So I think one of the early things that companies need to think about is if we're going to internationalize, we need a corporate language strategy, and that strategy has to be coherent. So it needs to hang together well across the whole network,
right?
And it needs to be congruent with the business objectives. So I'll just speak about two examples. There's a Japanese internet company that has gone global, and the CEO of that company, early on, he decided that he wanted English to be the corporate language. But and that's fine, but he went to the extreme of that in the sense that he changed the corporate language from Japanese to English everywhere, even in Japan, among Japanese. So he mandated that people who are Japanese speaking to each other in the company would speak in English, not in Japanese. So that's one extreme. IBM, on the other hand, also adopted English as their corporate language, but they also promoted 8 other languages. So they adopted a strategy that was more nuanced. So I'm not saying that one is better than the other. I guess it depends what you're doing, what your goals are. That's why I say it needs to be congruent and it needs to be coherent. But what it does need to be is you need to have one. You can't just leave it to chance, because then that would be just chaos. Okay. So helping companies to work out what their corporate language strategy should be, and then guiding, and I think it's important that we don't implement the strategy, but we guide and sometimes cajole and encourage the executives of the company to implement the strategy that we've helped them to develop, because it's important that they own this, that they internalize this, and that they roll it out themselves.
Okay, fantastic. So of course I would be remiss as a foresight strategist if I didn't ask you, where do you see the future of globalization and internationalism in terms of, you know, how are you hopeful that Americans will be able to join what is already happening globally? And I think we're probably the ones that are lagging most behind.
Well, it's yes and no, in the sense that many of on the political front, America has been the motor behind many of the post-World War II political developments that have driven globalization. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and to a certain degree the United Nations, and all of these supranational bodies were driven in the early days by America. So America on the political front has always been, I think, well, I won't say always, but has been, at least since the end of World War II, has been very global in its focus. And that changes from administration to administration, and perhaps the administration that we have at the moment tends to be more of a of an inward-looking administration. But the cycle will turn. I think the big arc, the big arc of history is more towards an outward-looking America than an inward-looking America. So it may turn in from time to time, but I think in the long run it will it will come back out. I think in terms of trade and what private companies and private individuals do, I think regardless of the political movements, the ebbing and flowing of that global focus, businesses are always looking for opportunity, and the opportunities are there or real. If the politicians put obstacles in the way, business people will find ways around them. You know, they'll absorb the costs, or they'll innovate to get around the costs. But I think the irony, I think, from an American point of view, is that it really is the American lead companies that are the most global, but at the same time, it's the American medium and smaller companies that perhaps are the most inward looking. So you have both things going on at the same time. So what I'm talking about is trying to get them the big middle of the smaller to medium sized American companies switched on to the opportunities of internationalization. You know, the Facebooks and the Googles and the Twitters and all, they've got it already. It's the other guys. It's the other guys.
Fantastic. So I want to thank you so much, Patrick, for sharing this information, which I think is fascinating. And I always say that if nothing else, to be able to broaden the mind of the audience and to help them to start thinking differently. So I'm quite fascinated by this. I'm very fascinated by international. And I think that's because, you know, I'm half South American.
Yeah.
So I've always had a passion for, I've always loved to travel, and I love languages and I love cultures, but doing business has been something that I've always dreamt of, but never quite taken that step. And this is what I'm looking for in the future. But I think it's fascinating that people start thinking this way. And I always feel if I can at least jar their, give them information and start jarring their minds to start thinking this way, the next steps are, you know, just makes it that much easier. So I want to thank you so much for being here and taking your time. I know I'm smack in the middle of your day. So I want to thank you for taking the time and being with us. So when you have that book, I would love to have you back and talk about the book and, you know, to, again, to revisit this idea. Okay.
I'd be delighted to do that. And thank you very much. Muchas gracias. Que ha sido un placer.
Igual, igual. Bueno, adiós y hasta la próxima.
Hasta la próxima. Adiós, adiós.
Thanks for listening to the Dr. Nilda Business Foresight Show. You can hear Dr. Nilda every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and anytime on demand on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. For more information on the featured guest, go to www.drnildaperez.com/show.